This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Today is September 6th, 2005. This interview is with Professor Daniel Cunanna of the Emeritus of the Department of African Languages and Literature. And to begin the interview, Professor, perhaps you want to start with telling us where you were born and when.
Yes, I was born in a little town called Edenville in a state called Orange Free State in South Africa on the 13th of April 1923. Mm-hmm. At that time, there was strict segregation. I mean, people seem to always think about apartheid when you talk about South Africa, the segregation that was really strengthened in 1948. Mm-hmm. But there was historically strict segregation, typified typically by residence, where you had white people living in a white area that was called town, black people living in a black area that was called location. Now the term location, I don't know its origin, but it certainly was not originated by the blacks. It was originated by the whites way back to designate a place where only blacks lived. Uh-huh. So as we grow up, actually, in our ordinary conversation, the terminology of town and location became understood to mean white for town and location for blacks. In terms of the postal, your postal address, you gave the same name, Edenville, and then if you're living in the black area, you'd say Edenville location.
Oh.
The whites just said Edenville, and so location. That was how we designated where each group lived. Town was where the whites lived, as I said, and where the jobs were. Location was basically a dormitory place where our fathers came, tired from their manual labor, ready to eat, and maybe let's sit around the fire for a little bit and have some stories, etc., etc., and then basically just to come back home and go to bed after eating. Mm-hmm. So dormitory, really, in that sense. Of course, I'm not trying to minimize the extent that we did have time to interact as families. My family, for example, as I just said, we would have time often after our evening meal for us to do some storytelling. My mother was the expert as far as that went, storyteller, and we sat around and absolutely got thrilled by the stories we heard. And my mother used to put in a lot of passion into her storytelling, and so in fact she lived the parts that she was narrating about. My father did tell a story from time to time. It used to be a little bit ponderous and so on, but he had one favorite story that he told almost every time he took over the storytelling. So I'm saying then that the blacks in the locations were cheap labor for the whites in the town. Mm-hmm. And so there was this daily migration out of the location to town, to the white area, people going to work as domestic servants, as petrol station attendants, as you know, loading people who loaded the trucks that went to the railway station, all that sort of thing, and that was the order of the day. In fact, this reminds me that for quite some time, for quite a few years, when I was still small, our parents working in, let's say, a place like a store, a general dealer store, were not given time off for lunch. They worked straight through from the morning when they got there and until they came back home, and they had to sneak time in. One might go and you know, make a fire quickly out in the back room over there, and you know, cook some mush, you know, cornmeal mush, etc. And then before he's missed, he'd have to rush back. Another one goes and takes over until, you know, they're done. And they have to again to keep sneaking out to go and eat standing, and so on. But eventually, after several years, a law was enacted that required them to be given an hour, middle of the day, sort of 1 o'clock-ish, to have their lunch without having to be harassed, you know, and so on. So anyway, that's how people lived there. Our town, our location and the town were separated by well over a mile, maybe a mile and a half of just, you know, you might say no man's land. But it was pasture grounds where, you know, people who had some animals like cows, etc., you know, herded their cows during the day in the morning, or horses, and brought them home in the afternoon. So we had that spatial, no man's land kind of separation, so there could be no mistake as to where the blacks lived and where the whites lived.
Did whites ever come into the location?
They did, but it was always kind of a scary thing when you saw a white. You thought, now what's wrong? What have we done? Because they would come. Sometimes a farmer might come in his horse cart, selling some produce. Sometimes the superintendent would come to find people who hadn't paid their rent, because sometimes people were in arrears with their rent and so on. In other words, I'm just saying, whites never came to visit, just as blacks didn't go to them in the white town to visit. It was strictly master-servant relationship, and when the master came to your humble dwelling, it wasn't always for something good. Of course, to say nothing about the police. The police, you know, raided to find out, you know, if people were having drinking parties or, you know, because drinking was illegal. Even home brew, you had to get a permit. Our parents had to go and get permission to brew beer at home with corn and sorghum and so on and so forth. Without that, you were arrested. So to ensure that people behaved, they didn't have liquor without having their permits, they would raid at night from time to time. There was a curfew as well. After 9 o'clock, no black should be seen in the white part, or they are arrested.
In the town?
In the town, yeah. In the town. In the location, of course, nobody bothered except our parents, you know, when we're small, because they want us to come back home, even while we're still playing in the moonlight, etc., etc., which we did quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, there was a curfew in the town where after 9 p.m., if you were seen around there, you went straight to jail.
Can I ask you, based on your knowledge, was the segregation in South Africa at this time comparable to that in the southern United States, or even at that time was it more brutal than what American blacks were faced with in the South?
You know, I don't feel qualified to make the comparison because I have not really went to stay in the South enough to know. But just from what I'm told, in terms of its severity, yes, very, very comparable.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost as if you were natural enemies. I still remember that there was a house sort of a little bit away from town, standing by itself, sitting by itself there. And I'm trying to remember what this meant, that this is a white house, a little bit away from the town. And I don't remember what man's function was, but he had some function in the municipality. His young boys would make a point of sometimes waylaying black children passing there and just attack them, beat them up, and so on. So, you know, you had that kind of almost like revulsion or hatred or, you know, at least a dislike of the other people.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, somehow even in us children, there was that feeling that white people are not our friends. You never expected that they would be your friends.
Uh-huh.
Right. So those animosities, even by little white children, would be a matter of, exerting their superiority, and that they could do whatever they liked.
Okay.
Now, I guess, you know, I'd just like to also talk then about schooling for me at that time. Now, having indicated, you know, that obviously we couldn't have been going to the same school, the whites and the blacks. I attended, of course, I lived in the location and attended school there. In Edenville, and I think in many other towns of its size, well, certainly let me talk about what I know. In Edenville, there was no school building where school was held. I'm not even using the plural to say school buildings. There wasn't one.
Huh.
Classes were held in churches, in church buildings. I still remember that the first 2 years of class, which were called Substandard A and Substandard B, were held in Edenville, were held in the Wesleyan Methodist Church building. Then standards 1 and 2, I think standards 1 and 2, yeah, 1 and 2 were held at the AME Church, African Methodist Episcopal,
mm-hmm.
And then 3, 4, 5, 6 were held at the Dutch Reformed Church building. They were separated, you know, quite a bit. And I don't think there's any significance in which classes were held at which school. It just became that way.
Uh-huh.
All the buildings, all the school buildings, I mean the churches, just like the houses in the location, had mud floors. Now, people in the location from time to time used mud mixed with dung to plaster the floor to freshen them up. At the church buildings, every Friday, we school children had to be engaged in the process of renewing the floors by plastering them with mud. The ritual was this. The boys dug the soil and then went and fetched water. There was no water, there were no water taps. I mean, not even in the streets. You had to go to a little creek, a stream passing down there, to carry water from there, to come and mix this mud. Mix it to until it reaches the right consistency. Then it was the girls' turn at this point. They now tucked their little gym dresses, you know, into their bloomers and knelt down and plastered and plastered, you know, and just kept going backwards, you know, plastering this floor until they had covered it. So that's what it meant, at least partly, to be in a church building that didn't have wooden floors.
Mm-hmm.
So the plastering then was part of this whole thing. And then there was the syllabus. The syllabus was very, very Bible-oriented. Any subject, let's say humanities, let's say what you read, stories, was very, very much Bible-oriented and pepped up, you know, with biblical references, etc. Only things like arithmetic and so on, of course, there's nothing that could be done to make it a biblical arithmetic. it was, you know, one and one are two and two are four, regardless of what religion you subscribe to, and so on. But generally, the Bible studies, that was one of the most important things, to the extent that, well, I don't know why, to the extent, of course, that every morning school began with an assembly where you sang hymns, and then the teacher prayed, and then you went into your classes. And then every Monday morning, our teacher would line us up and one by one ask us, did you go to church yesterday?
Really?
Yes. Did you go to church yesterday? If you said no, why? I was sick. Okay, can somebody verify that? Can I ask your mother? Yes, yes. Did you go to church yesterday? Yes. Who was the preacher? Oh, it was Father Sancho, lay preacher. What part of the Bible did he read from? He read from Genesis. Can you tell me what he said? Just tell me. Oh, when the children of Israel were in the desert, or whatever, you know. So you were quizzed to make sure that you had gone to church the day before, or you didn't go for a valid reason, sickness, for example. The consequence of not having gone to church without a valid reason was punishment. You're going to get some lashes and warned, never stay away from church.
Were all of the black children expected to go to school? Or was that a decision of the parents?
Well, let's put it this way. In fact, that's what I was going to come to next.
Okay.
Because I was going to say, school, I don't want to say optional. It wasn't optional. Parents wanted their children to go to school. Mm-hmm. Parents, you know, would raise heaven and earth to have their children go to school. We as blacks had hurdles that the whites did not have. Mm-hmm. We had to pay school fees, quarterly fees.
Ah.
If your parents could not afford to pay, you stay away from school. No questions asked. You just don't show up when the books say that your parents owe school fees. Whites did not have to pay school fees. We bought our own books. Our parents bought books for us. And we heard whites did not have to buy books. Their books were provided. So the poorest people were being burdened with all these extra expenses to have their children educated that the richer white people, quite a bit richer I should say, did not have these additional financial obligations imposed on them. So here we are now, you know, we're dealing with poverty, we're dealing with every possible hurdle put in the way of children and parents who want their children to go to school. I remember that, in fact, sometimes, you see, the white golfers played on Wednesday early afternoon and Saturday. And we went there to offer to caddy for them.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think we can guess how much we were paid, but we still appreciated it. We were paid 3 pennies for caddying a 9-hole course.
Oh my God.
3 pennies, a tiki. On Saturdays, they played 2 rounds, then you got 6 pennies for having carried for 2 rounds, 9 holes each. But, you know, we still did it. We still did it because we needed the money. We needed to the extent that we could, you know, be of some help to our parents. I remember one time my older brother and I, I don't know at whose suggestion, whether it was our mother's suggestion, but we, whenever we went to caddy, would give the money to our mother to keep for us, went to caddy and so on and so forth. I think we ended up with an excitement because we had collected 6 shillings. Now, 6 shillings at that time, we're talking about when the... let me just compare right now. 6 shillings would have been maybe less than $1.
Oh.
Yeah. So anyway, that's what we used to do also, to go out to caddy. And sometimes in order to caddy on Wednesday, you had to skip the second half of school. After the intermission, the interval when you we all ran home to go and have something to eat, then you might just sneak away because you needed to go and caddy and bring those 3 pennies home.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as can be, as anybody can guess by now, the dropout rate of children, my peers and so on, was very high.
Mm-hmm.
It was high because of the hurdles having to have school fees, having to buy books and so on, and having poor parents who, even without paying your school fees, were still finding it difficult to give you a decent food, decent meal. We slept on the floor without a mattress, and so on and so forth. So one of the reasons of the dropping out was that whatever you can earn, doing whatever job you know you could get in the white town would help the family income,
mm-hmm.
would help your parents to be able to sustain the family. So dropping out was such a common thing, you know, because you were being discouraged every turn, you know, left, right, front, center, you just had hurdles. And you had to have some kind of will and determination to go on.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I think parents actually encourage their children to drop out.
Really?
For the reasons that I just gave.
Mm-hmm.
But also, Bob, I should emphasize how much our parents appreciated education, how much they wanted us to have education.
Mm-hmm.
They took education as something that gave you power. It gave you power. When you get to a certain level, if you got a job, you know, maybe a teacher and so on, of course you had status in the community, but you also were earning a reasonable amount of money, etc. So for all these reasons, our parents were, in fact, very keen that their children should get education.
How many brothers and sisters did you have?
I had altogether, there were, how many of us, let's see, there were four boys, yeah, and two girls.
Uh-huh.
And the eldest was a girl,
uh-huh.
Right, and so on. And I'm going to be sort of referring to them as we go on, but we were at one point all in school at the same time in the primary school.
Wow.
Yeah. And what the community, in fact, this love to have children educated manifested itself also in the appreciation of an educated child. Now, at Edenville location, you were educated, well, basically once you knew how to read or write your own language,
mm-hmm.
A little bit of English, which was also regarded as a mark of distinction, you know, the more English you knew, the better. But when you were able to read and write and so on, and lead your little boy in the community, everybody, you know, everybody in the community priding themselves in your skills had also the privilege, almost the right, to just call you, hey, young fellow, come here. I got this letter from my son in Johannesburg. Could you please read it for me?
Uh-huh.
You do that. Maybe then, okay, you must come tomorrow again, son. Come and write the letter back to my son. Okay, you're there. They give you a pad, and they dictate to you what you're to say, and so on. And you sometimes say, please slow. Go slower, because, you know, I'm writing, and the words are just popping out, coming out like that, you know.
Oh.
But the point I'm trying to make here is that now, again, this little community felt a communal profit from any child who had got some education. And that, you know, and even our parents, not only they didn't mind, but they actually were proud that people would just call us to say, come and write a letter for me, and so on. We're basically, you know, universal secretaries, you know, the whole location, and so on. So I look back at that with some nostalgia, because I don't know if I appreciated it at that time as much as I do now, that in fact the whole community was benefiting from your skills, writing and reading that you had learned at school.
How old were you at this point when you were able to read letters for your elders and write letters?
I would say approximately maybe by the time I was 10, I was able to do that, maybe even a little before that. And then also, you know, there were many lay preachers.
This is side two of tape one of the September 6, 2005 interview with Emeritus Professor Daniel Cunanan.
Well, the lay preachers very often were either not literate, could not read, but somehow, you know, that did not prevent them. They almost knew the Bible by heart. They could quote verses from the Bible. Yes. You know, how orality, where you don't depend on the eye to read and so on, sharpens your mind, your memory, because you have to depend on that.
Uh-huh.
And they had the sense of knowing, you know, Psalm number so and so, or, you know, Exodus, or etc. And they would tell you. Then, often, standing there in front of the congregation, they would, rather than struggling, you know, and trying to read when they really couldn't, they'll just call you from the congregation.
Really?
Hey, Sonny, come here. Come and read these verses for me.
Really?
And the congregation is there.
During the service?
Oh, during the service. During the service. They just call you, come and read this. And then you get there, and, you know, you read the verses in the Bible, and so on. Thank you, my son. Go sit down. And then he starts his sermon. So, I mean, you know, we were very important. We were really very highly appreciated by our community. And, you know, I cannot emphasize that enough, just to show the extent to which people appreciated what we had got by being in school. And to go back and say, you can see from that that every parent would have liked their child to be in that position of having learned the skills of reading and writing and so on. I think any parent who would have called you from the street and said, hey, young man, come here, come and read this letter for me, or come and write a letter for me. I mean, by that act alone, you know that they would have been very happy to have their children also be able to have those skills. I mean, you know, you can see how they are appreciating it just by using communally your skills.
Dame, can I ask you, were both of your parents working at this time, or just your father?
Well, both of them actually, but my mother took in washing. You know, laundry from town, from the whites. You had to go in, you meaning either my mother would go to pick it up from whichever white person she was doing laundry for,
uh-huh.
or sent us, the children, to go and pick it up, and then she washes it. And as I say, you know, not any source of water anywhere except that stream flowing past. And that's where they wash the washing. And they develop the skills of, you know, you wash it, then you bleach it by soaping it and then spreading it on the grass.
Uh-huh.
And letting the sun, you know, do some bleaching, bring it back, rinse it, and then take it home to iron it and so on. And when it's all done, either my mother would take it herself, or again she would send us to deliver it. This was a kind of once a week thing. If she did washing for just one family, a white family, but some people did it for several, you know, so that they were occupied more days in the week than just two, you know, washing day, ironing day, etc., etc.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but again, you know, judging, I mean, you could understand that having myself been exploited by working at caddying.
Uh-huh.
For 3 pennies for a 9-hole course. Everybody was exploited. Every black person was exploited. It was cheap labor because they had no choice.
Yes.
And you know, it was a very, very tough situation. I said that the first 2 years of school were called substandards,
uh-huh.
substandard A and substandard B.
Uh-huh.
And then from there it was standard 1, standard 2, and so on and so forth. Standard 6 was the highest level that we could reach in the location. There was nothing offered, no school offering anything beyond.
Oh.
I mean, in Edenville location.
Uh-huh.
Right. It was different in the white schools. I mean, they could go to the secondary level and still be at home beyond standard 6 by 2 or 3 years before they would have to separate from their parents.
I see.
Now, for us, standard 6 was the highest. Now, there was the final exams. I mean, this was considered so important. The final exams were set in the capital of the state.
Oh.
They were set there, they were printed there, they were put in sealed envelopes there. And we didn't write our names on our exam books, but we were given numbers. So there was this anonymity that they wouldn't know who you are. And the sealed envelopes were, you know, torn open while we were sitting there ready with our pens and so on, in our presence, often in front of another witness, just to say, you know, these are being opened right this minute. Anybody is going to just see them now, never before. And then they would be distributed and you were told, keep it upside down until they were all distributed. And then when you're given the signal to start, then you turn them around and begin to read the questions and begin to write your answers. It was a kind of a great, almost solemn occasion for the location, for the community. These highest educated young people, these children of ours, you know, who are going to write this high examination that, you know, the questions come from Bloemfontein and, you know, they're in sealed. I mean, you know, it was all that ritual, not only a ritual, though, but to make sure that nobody knew what the questions were going to be until they were right there in front of you. I remember that when one of the years, or let me just say, when I did Standard 6, and by the way, by that time, my older siblings, my older sister, the firstborn, and my brother, the secondborn, my sister's name was Sophia. And my brother was, you know, Elias or Elias.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, people pronounced it in different ways, Elias. So, you know, we all got bunched up in Standard 6 because I had got automatic promotions because I was just going through things so easily, and the teacher didn't see any reason to let me do the formality of spending a year here, spending a year there, when in fact I could just go and join the people who were already in Standard 6 and do as well, if not better, than them. So we, the three of us, got bunched up in Standard 6. And it's very strange, because when the final results came, I was top. My brother was second and my sister third, you know.
Oh my gosh.
It was just as if you see, the height of my fingers had been reversed. Number one, number two, number three. But you know, that's going to later, just not too long, I'm going to be talking about that again, about how this bunching up of us in Standard 6. But right now, I just want to say the extent to which this was an achievement that was felt throughout this community, the black community, was heightened by the fact that the Reverend Mahomo, who was then the minister of the Dutch Reformed Church, the location Dutch Reformed Church, was the appointed invigilator, the one who did the, watching over us when we were writing the exams and distributing the papers and so on, collecting the papers, etc. But what he did do, which made it even more significant, was every day of the exams to indicate the beginning of the first exam, he would have the church bell ringing. So I mean, you know, that just meant, you know, Standard 6 exam is beginning, day one, and then beginning of day two as well. Ding, ding, ding. I mean, just ring the bell. And of course, I mean, the sound went right through the whole location.
And so everyone knew.
Everyone knew. And we felt very important.
How old are you now?
At that time, I was 12.
12.
13.
Okay.
I was 13 at that time.
So Standard 6 is like our 6th grade here in the United States? Or is Standard 6 more like 7th or 8th grade?
Difficult to compare, really, because given that we didn't have kindergarten or anything like that, Substandard A was the beginning of actual formal education.
Oh, it was?
Yes.
Okay.
You were being introduced to reading, to learning how to spell and so on. Substandard B was the next step after that. And these took a year each. You were one whole year in one standard, whether it was substandard A, substandard B, or standard 1, standard 2, etc., etc. It was all 1 year. Oh, and then I should mention also how strict, strictly controlled was the, well, controlled I don't think is a word, but you're passing a certain standard to go to the next one depended on how you did. If you got marks below a certain point, you stayed back there for another year. You know, that's why when we first got to this country and I heard about automatic promotion in the elementary schools in order to keep the peer group together and all that, I was amazed. Yes. I didn't know, so what's the purpose? If they are not going to earn promotion to the next grade by showing mastery of the work that they've learned in the previous grade.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the whole point?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you say, okay, go on. You know, celebrate your next birthday and pass on. Celebrate your next birthday, pass on, and so on and so forth. No. We had sometimes mixtures of heights and ages and so on in the same class because people had to earn their passing on to the next grade by passing their exams, by showing that they had mastered the work. This is how this was conducted. I mean, you either passed or you failed. Pass, fail. And if you failed, you stayed back for another year. Now, standard 6 then, where there we were, you know, the most highly educated little boys and girls in the community. Bells,
well, you
bells,
were somebody.
Church bells ringing, you know, and so on, and announcing we were going to write our final exam.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Reverend Mahomo also, every time the first, you know, after we wrote the first papers in the morning, the exam might go on over 3 days maybe, he would invite us all to his house for tea and cakes.
Huh.
The cakes would have been baked by no less a person than the Reverend's wife, Mrs. Mahomo.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. And something that was such a special treat for us because it wasn't something that we had often. Cake was, you know, it's Marie Antoinette, I suppose. Her circus, you know, it's just incredible. You know, that was really, really a special thing.
Yeah, I have to ask you about your family. It strikes me as quite extraordinary that there would have been three of you who had stayed in, from one family, who had stayed in school long enough to reach standard 6 and taking the exam. Your family must have been extraordinary in the location.
Oh, extraordinary indeed, in the sense, and especially our mother, she was really the one, the staunchest one in terms of making sure that we continue to get our education.
Was she educated?
No. She could barely write. I mean, she could write, but very, very slowly. My father was more fluent in his writing and so on and so forth. He had had more schooling than my mother. But, you know, so much did people consider education something that gave you, as I said before, power.
Yes.
In all kinds of ways. including the fact that, you know, the more educated people were, the less afraid of confronting whites they were.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they had a, that sense of, you know, don't try to bully me, and so on, you know, I have some power.
Yes.
Even though it's not as much as yours, but, you know.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Everybody, and I, of course I'm talking about myself, and my mother, the mother of my siblings as well, she was absolutely, she fought like a, well, she was of the lion clan, so she was a lion, a lioness, you know, and which takes me back now. Okay, we finished standard six. To begin higher education, which could be compared with maybe middle school here, the secondary school level, we had to leave home, as I said, because it was not available for blacks in Edenville. The nearest bigger town where they had secondary and high school up to, well, they didn't have matric. I think they did have matric at that time. I don't know. Matriculation would have been the point where you are prepared, you're getting ready to go to university after that. But other than that, I mean, there would be the what was called Form 1, which otherwise was standard 7, Form 2, otherwise standard 8, Form 3, which was the point where, again, there was another milestone, Form 3 gave you the point where you were going to sit for exams for what was called the junior certificate. The junior certificate. And same thing as was done at Edenville, except, I mean, there wasn't all the church bells and things like that, but I mean, the exams were sealed. You had numbers instead of your names, etc., etc., anonymity again. And after Form 3, and you write that junior certificate, the certificate comes again from the capital of the state, your name on it, etc., etc. But let me backtrack a little bit here. I said we were bunched up, you know, at Standard 6.
Mm-hmm.
So when my parents now had to decide, after we all three passed, they couldn't possibly send us all to Kronstadt financially. Financially, that was just impossible, to go and start our secondary education. Family gathering and so on and so forth. Okay, the oldest son first. So it's my older brother who's chosen to go to Kronstadt. So what do I do? In the meantime, the first year that I could have gone to secondary school but did not, my parents, including, of course, with the advice of the teachers, etc., let me continue, go back and study Standard 6 again. Now, I had passed with the first class the first time.
Mm-hmm.
So I repeat it. This is now 1930. What year would that have been? I think it was 36. Well, 36 is when I first passed it.
Yes, you were 13.
And I was 13. And then 1937 was when I would have gone to Kronstadt, but didn't, and had to spend, they said, well, go back, do it again. I did it again in 37. I got another first class pass. The next year, I think we're off by a year here, because I would say my brother went there 36 and 37, right? That's where we are now, right?
Correct.
Okay, in 37, 36 is when
you would have taken...
No, things have to be different here, because I think I wrote the Standard 6 exam the first time in 35 when I was 12.
Oh, okay.
When I would have been in Standard 5, but had been promoted to Standard 6 and passed first class. So, yeah, so the next year was 36, when I repeated it in order to be kept off the streets, got another first class. The next year, which was 37, my brother went again for a second time to Kronstadt. I still could not go. And this time, I did three little jobs. The first one, there was this old Dutch woman for whom my mother did washing, and who lived alone, Mrs. Kutsier. She looked forward to my mother coming because she was lonely. So, you know, there was hardly any washing, but, you know, my mother took whatever there was. Sometimes for situations like that, my mother would go there, not even bring it home, and just wash it there.
Oh.
Let it dry and iron it and so on. So, and then Mrs. Kutsier, you know, she would just keep my mother there, you know, conversing. And, you know, we all had to learn the master's language. So my our parents in the location spoke a kind of Afrikaans, you know, derivative from the Dutch language. That got them, you know, communicating with their employers. So, you know, there would be the socializing with my mother. And then this is now the what would have been my third year repeating Standard 6.
Mm-hmm.
But that was getting too monotonous, and, you know, I got to do something else. And my mother talked to this old Dutch woman. Could she give me a little job? Okay, she will. I will be kind of handy around the house, you know, sent on errands and doing chores, maybe in the garden, you know, all that sort of thing. Including, she owned a cow. Getting there early enough to drive the car to pasture, you know, in the camp. There were about three grazing camps, including the one that separated the location from the white town.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, drive the cow there, open the gate, drive the cow in and shut the gate, and come back now and be around the house until milking time. Then I have to go and get the cow again from the grazing camp and bring it back. I did that for 1 month, for which I was paid a penny a day.
Wow.
1 penny a day. I mean, at the end of that month, I had, what you see, at that time South Africa used the British monetary system,
mm-hmm,
of pounds, shillings, and pence. And
mm-hmm.
So the penny a day, 30 pennies, you know, over the month, was 2 shillings and 6 pence, half crown. So I had this little coin here. And I quit. You know, I just couldn't stand it. Mm-hmm. And then somehow, through my teachers, they got me a teaching job on at a farm school. I have no experience as a teacher. I just had the academic knowledge that I'd got from sub 8 to standard 6. And you know, I sort of knew how my teachers taught me, and so I was going to mimic their way of teaching and hold classes, and I did that. Now, one thing that I didn't do, which people said, "Hey, you're lucky you didn't get into trouble with a farmer, the white farmer," because this was a white farmer's farm, and with the workers, black workers, you know, again, separated and living in their little houses, and their children having to come to school. Sometimes it would be children not only of this farm, but other adjacent farms. Mm-hmm. And so I held that job for, I think, maybe a quarter, 3 months or something. And it was temporary to begin with. And then they got me another teaching job, this time in Edenville itself.
Oh.
So I was teaching in the lowest grades, etc. But there I was. And I was kind of short, you know, and I'm told my head was a little too big for my size. But anyway, I was a teacher wearing shorts. Now, shorts, let me digress here. There was this significance of long pants, short pants.
Yes.
A child wore short pants. The father and the older man wore long pants. No child wore long pants. It was a significant...
This is tape number 2 of the September 6, 2005 interview with Emeritus Professor Daniel Cunanan.
Well, there was this thing of, you know, kind of ritualizing the length of pants, you know. Yes. I wear long pants, therefore I'm in charge. Uh-huh. You wear short pants, you're a child, and don't forget that. So even as this teacher at Edenville, I was wearing short pants. Because teacher or no teacher, I was still a child.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Did you have much trouble controlling the students?
Mm-mm. No, there's this difference again with the American schools as I know them, from the time that I got to this country, and I think it's been getting more and more so. Discipline in our school, when I used to go to school, was understood to be part of the building of your character. And discipline, which could take any form, it could take the form of physical punishment, you know, being given lashes. Mm-hmm. I know I had my share of that when at young, you know, sort of, you know, time of rebellion. Mm-hmm. I was skipping school. In fact, this will give me an opportunity again to show how much my mother really was determined that we are going to have education. I remember, you know, I don't know what happened in my head. I just refused to go to school. I think I was at that time in standard three, four maybe, which would be the first half of the 30s. Something had gone in my head. I'm not going to school. And first day, and then I just wandered off and went to town and wandered about there. Second day, again, now I wasn't going to school, and my mother said, "You are going to school." And I started to run away, and of course she couldn't keep up with me. And my uncle had a dog, and then my mother set the dog on me to help her to catch. The dog knew me, so we just ran together. So, and I remember my mother throwing old tea kettles at me, "Come on, come back," and so on. I ran. And then again went to town and wandered about. And when I ended up, you know, they had a little, very, very, something constructed with corrugated iron sheets for the white golfers, you know, that's where they got in and whatever, changed their, whatever they did, you know, when they first came there and to play. And I sat on the other side of this little house, on the side of it, facing down, just sitting there, aimless. I mean, you know, I, if somebody said, "What are you doing there?" I'd say, I don't know, I'm just sitting. And the two bigger boys, the two big boys who were sent out to go and look for me, this is on the second day. And they had gone to town and apparently scoured and so on and so forth, looked everywhere. And they were walking back when they saw me, I saw them, and they were at quite some distance. And the moment I saw them, coming, running towards me, I just slid around to the other side of this building and then took off. And I don't know what gave me that sense that, you know, they won't see that I'm running until I'm quite far because I'd be hidden by this house. So I was running, and true enough, when they said what had happened, they had thought that I just slid to the other side to hide. But by the time they saw me, I was running. I was on my way to some big gate that was going to go into a farm, a farmer's, the gate that went into his farm, a white farm. Again, of course, obviously, there were no black farmers. So now, by now, they were hot on my heels, and I was running like heck. I got through that gate, and then turned sharp right, ran along the fence, and running along that fence, I was going to pass by the house of one of the black workers on that farm. I come running, and these two hot on my heels, and then there's a woman outside who's I think she was hanging some washing and so on, a black woman. And then she says, "Hey, young man or little fella, why are these people chasing you?" And then, stupidly, I stand there and converse with her. They're chasing me. They want me to go to school. So why don't you want to go to school? I said, because I have a sore foot. And I'd been running for at least a mile on this sore foot. No way. I mean, she just laughed, you know, because she realized that I was just not telling the truth, and I had no reason, no good reason. And meanwhile, of course, they've caught up with me now.
Yes.
They've caught up, and they grabbed me on both sides and walked me back.
To school?
Back to school. It's quite a way to walk now, so we go. A footnote here. It was afterwards, when I was quite a bit older, that I saw that my stopping there and talking with this woman who's asking me these questions and letting them catch up with me was probably a blessing in disguise, because not far from there was this stream that was running, a stream of water, and where I probably would have thrown myself into there and could have drowned if I did that. But somehow this thing that was driving me, let me run away from them because I don't want to go to school, it was there. And okay, they caught me, walked me back, got me into school, and I got the threshing of my life. In fact, you know, the lash was getting behind one of my knees.
Oh.
And tore the skin. And I was bleeding and limping when I went home for interval.
Who lashed you? The teacher?
The teacher. The teacher. Made an example of me. Now, normally parents would say, well, you know, the teacher was in loco parentis, in your relationship to them, as long as you were away from your parents, they had all the rights of parents, discipline you, and so on and so forth. So, but this one made my mother say, no, this is going too far. But anyway, you know, there was nothing that she could do. She wanted, you know, so I healed and everything was back to normal. So that was just an example again of two things, I suppose. One, my mother's persistence and insistence that we should get education. If you're going to rebel, I'm going to throw old kettles at you and, set a dog on you and so on, and then go and report to you, to the principal, and they're going to catch you, etc., and uh-huh. discipline you. Now, so here we are. At last it's my turn, and it's 1938, because 36 was my first repeating, and the 37 was these bits of teaching and so on. And now 38, when I was 15, is when I got my first chance to go to Kronstadt for secondary education. I'd like to, you know, sort of end this segment of our interview by saying, here I am having this additional expense on my parents' part that whites did not have to do, and having the trauma of separation.
Mm-hmm.
But in addition, going to Kronstadt, where there were no dorms, no dormitories, no facilities for students who came out of town to live. So what our parents did would be, and again my mother, if they knew somebody, if they had even a distant family in the place, they would go there to say, look, I'm bringing my child to school here, and I'm looking for a place for him. Can he stay with you? And, you know, we'll support you the best way we can. Nothing formal, no, you know, it's going to be this much a month or anything, but, you know. And they either said yes or no. Very often, if they were family members, they would find it difficult to say no.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes total strangers. Mm-hmm. You know, you can imagine your mother is walking with you, you're having your luggage in these dusty streets, you know, knocking on doors. That was the only way that you're going to get a place to stay, get this education. That was the only way that we're going to do it. And people were different. You stayed sometimes, but most of them kind of made you a kind of a house help at the same time. So they many of them exploited the situation. So, you know, you scrubbed their floors, you polished their furniture, you went to town to buy groceries and so on and so forth. So, you know, and sometimes you had to go right home and say, well, I can't stand being in this family anymore,
mm-hmm.
And so on and so forth. So, I think one of the most important things here was that we were uprooted from our home. I was uprooted from Edenville.
Mm-hmm.
And with no assurance that I will find, my mother would find a place for me to stay, I might have to just go back to Edenville again until we'd be able to find someone who could take me in and so on. So I stayed with quite a few families while I was studying there. Sometimes, you know, a family might have a separate room in the backyard and so on, if you can stay there and do your own cooking and so on and so forth.
Hmm.
But mostly you were staying with them in the house and as I say, very often becoming a kind of free house help, you know, that they fully exploited.
Did your mother find these places, or did you have to find them?
No, my mother did, because I was still, you know, a minor to start with. I couldn't have been going there knocking on doors and saying, mm-hmm. "Can you take me in?" No, it would have to be from my parents,
mm-hmm.
and as I say, my mother, to the other people, for them to come to an agreement. I was not part of the negotiations at all. I didn't do any negotiating,
uh-huh.
and that's how it was done, and that's how my secondary education began at Kronstadt Bantu High School. That was the name of the school.
And how far is Kronstadt from Edenville?
30 miles. At that time, 30 miles was a very long distance.
Yes.
Unpaved roads, you know, the main road, where, and then of course, again, the question of poverty, didn't even own a bicycle. And a bicycle was essential if you wanted to occasionally visit your parents without having to get on the train, which was expensive, and so on and so forth. Sometimes, you know, I'd borrow a bicycle from somebody and cycle. I don't remember how long it used to take to cycle those 30 miles. I don't know, two and a half, 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
probably three would be 10 miles per hour, and that's quite a lot. So I probably took a bit longer than that. And having cars passing and raising dust, you know, because the roads were unpaved. So, no? That's how it was. And, you know, I think that's a good place where I would like to stop our interview for today, Bob.